Getting your car ready for the winter months ahead. Before you know it, the leaves blowing across the streets and highways will be gone, and instead we'll be dealing with snow, ice, and salt-covered roads. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and today we welcome back two of our favorite guests, Jamie and John, to talk about getting your car or truck ready for the winter months ahead. They'll also share thoughts about what to buy if you're in the market for a new car, truck, or SUV, and they'll discuss an important new AAA study about distracted driving. Of course, our car gurus will also answer your questions on just about anything automotive, from whether it's time to replace your aging Accord or should you invest more money into your beloved Buick. Maine Calling gets its act in gear right after this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A new Cadillac and a new Tesla are both making headlines in the auto world and beyond. If you're looking for something a little more affordable, U.S. News & World Report has just released a list of the best small car deals to look for. Also, AAA just released a new study on distracted driving. We'll learn about some of the report's conclusions this hour and get to your car buying and car caring questions with our car gurus. Joining us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, Jamie Page Deaton, who is auto editor for U.S. News & World Report. Joining us from his office, John Paul. He is public affairs manager for AAA of Southern New England. He is also a certified mechanic and columnist for Boston.com. And as always, we want to hear from you. Are you in the market for a new car or truck? Are you confused about whether to buy or lease? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us back.
So I love to, if you are a listener who's hearing Jamie and John for the first time, I always ask what they've been driving. And the reason is, folks in car journalism, automotive journalism, get to drive different cars every week. Lucky dogs. And so, Jamie, what have you been driving?
I've been driving a bunch of different cars, but my favorite one that I've driven in a long time was the Land Rover Range Rover long wheelbase, which is basically your run-of-the-mill Range Rover, except they stretched it by 7.8 inches. So it's about the length of a Chevy Tahoe, and all of that space goes directly to the back seat. So it's essentially an off-road limousine that makes 510 horsepower, 461 pound-feet of torque, and, you know, it only costs $120,000. So, I mean, that's exactly what I need. You know, for the week that I had it, to take my kids to daycare and to go to the grocery store and things like that. But it really was just an exquisite car. I mean, the construction was so meticulous and well done. The materials were just opulent. It's way nicer than my house. All of the seats were massaging and heated and cooled, and every amenity you could want in a car, even some that, you know, you really hadn't thought that you wanted. After that, after being in that car, I was like, wow, every car needs to have massaging seats.
Massaging seats, we're going to be talking about the AAA study for distracted driving. That would distract me for sure. No kidding. John, what about you? What have you been driving?
Well, I've been driving a slightly less powerful car. It only had 450 horsepower, but it was a 2015 Corvette convertible.
Oh, nice time to be driving it during this Indian summer we had.
I didn't have it for a full week, but I had it for a few days, and in that time, I did everything I could to have the top down and just enjoy the car. But it's sort of interesting that today, you know, America's sports car, which the Corvette can still certainly hold that title, has less horsepower than a Range Rover.
Mm. And what's the price point on that?
It had a base price of $58,000.
Not bargain.
And it was as tested. I think it was $71,000 because it had a lot of trim and extra bits and pieces that went along with it. But you know, still sort of interesting. You could still buy a very nice sport utility vehicle and a Corvette for the price of the car that Jamie was driving.
So yeah, exactly. Have you been driving anything on the other end of the spectrum, the cars that people who are listening to us might actually buy. Maybe a couple of you out there in the market for a $120,000 car. But for most people, any regular people cars?
I'm in the 2015 Honda Accord this week. So, I mean, that is, if you want to talk about a regular person car, I think the Honda Accord is the embodiment of a regular person car. And, you know, it's one of those cars, it actually reminds me very strongly of actually pumpkin pie, because everybody likes pumpkin pie, but nobody really wants to eat it outside of Thanksgiving, because it's just great for what, you know, it's great for what it is. It's incredibly average, which works for most people. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to complain about in the Honda Accord, and that is a very, very good thing. You know, it doesn't necessarily set your heart aflutter, but a car for most people doesn't need to do that. The Accord has got plenty of room, plenty of power, nice and safe. It's got some nice tech features that are all very easy to use. It's a really good set it and forget it sort of car.
And isn't the Honda Accord famous for its dependability?
Yeah, that's another thing about it. I mean, it is exactly that. I mean, it's so dependable. If you really don't want to have to think about your car too much, I mean, the Honda Accord makes perfect sense.
And John Paul, what about you? What about on the other end of the spectrum, the not $58,000 or $71,000 spectrum?
Well, I was actually down in Florida for a few days for work. And while I was down there, I borrowed a 2015 Chrysler 200S, which is the sporty version of the Chrysler 200. This one happened to be a V6 powered car. Some of them are four-cylinder engines. It's built on a variation of a Fiat platform. Sort of a mid-sized car, maybe a little bit smaller than a Camry or an Accord. It had some really great features and some that I found somewhat annoying. The visibility out the front, car windshields today seem to be getting smaller and smaller, and it had a large rearview mirror, which was great to be able to see what was happening behind you, but it also blocked some forward visibility. And the side view mirrors, again, large side view mirrors, great to be able to see what's going off on to the left and right sides of you, but also blocked some visibility off to the side when you were taking a corner. A fun car to drive. It handled well. It rode well. It got reasonable gas mileage considering it was a V6 engine. But it's a car that I would really recommend to people. If they're thinking about buying it, drive it and drive it for more than the 15-minute test drive, because I would have found it annoying enough where I would have passed on the car. My wife was with me. She's about 6 inches shorter than I am. She didn't mind the rearview mirror issue so much, but she found the side view mirrors to be the same thing, sort of annoying. But maybe if you sit a little bit further back or tilt the seat, you could have gotten over that. But it wasn't exactly perfect because of that.
I want to talk about a couple of trends I've been reading about. One is there seem to be two trends going on where the super high-end luxury car makers are making cars that are a little less expensive, whether it's Aston Martin or Tesla. But then you have other brands. You were talking about the car you drove, the Land Rover, or you might think of the Cadillac, or seem to be making more expensive cars. What's going on out there, Jamie?
Well, it's actually very interesting. I mean, Cadillac is a luxury brand, but it's not one of those halo luxury brands like your Aston Martin would be, where it just seems so unobtainable. I mean, you can still, you know, if you work hard, you save your money, you could still end up in a Cadillac, or most people could, whereas most people are never going to be able to afford an Aston Martin. So Cadillac is actually bringing out a super high-end model because they feel like they are at the point where they can really compete with, say, the Audi A7s of the world, which is what this model is meant to compete with. And it's very interesting. It's part of a major change that Cadillac is undergoing. I mean, they are moving Cadillac's headquarters away from the rest of General Motors brand headquarters in Michigan, and they're moving it to New York. They've brought in a bunch of new executives, a bunch of new marketing people to really set Cadillac apart from GM's other brands and really hope to get some of that luxury cachet back in the brand.
John Paul, I want to ask you about this AAA study on distracted driving. I found it very interesting because sort of the headline and the lead of the story is that we are more distracted than we think we are with hands-free devices. But there seems to be a real variety depending on what brand of vehicle you have, that some brands are much less intuitive and distract people much more than others.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. In fact, the last time I think Jamie and I were on, we were talking about some of this hands-free voice guidance type technology. And Jamie said said the same thing that I was thinking, that sometimes what happens is the technology is so frustrating, you find yourself arguing with your car. You wanted to do something. You wanted to change a radio station. You wanted to adjust the climate control, and it wants you to load a CD in the CD player. There's a story about one of the bits of technology. Someone asked to tune the radio to 100.7, and it set the climate control on 100 degrees. So the technology isn't perfect yet. And what we found was some of it was better than others. The technology, the voice command technology from Toyota Lexus, was far superior than the voice technology from General Motors, for instance. In fact, what I found the best way to use the General Motors technology is to actually hit the OnStar button, talk to a real person, and have them download the information to the navigation system or whatever you want. So it's sort of a very convoluted way to get it to work. And then I think the Ford Sync system that's in a lot of the Ford products is legendary over the past few years and how frustrating it can become. So sometimes what happens is people think they're buying this technology, and the report shows that when people are trying to use it, and also there was a system where they were trying to catch a light that blinked in an optical device they were wearing, they kept missing the device. And in a lot of cases, what happens during some of the testing, people were going through stop signs, they weren't seeing cars that were on the road because they were actually dictating to the system or listening to messages or trying to get the systems to work. So in theory, it sounds like it would be a good idea. But the problem is it doesn't work the way it's supposed to yet. And what we're hoping is this study really goes back to the vehicle manufacturers, almost like crash testing does, where a vehicle manufacturer builds a car, finds out it doesn't do well in a particular crash test, and they rework the car. We're hoping the same thing will happen, where the vehicle manufacturers will look at this technology and decide there are things that work best for safety, and then there are other things that get developed in a car that are almost done just because the technology is available, and it's not necessarily something that's going to help people. In fact, people may find it far more distracting and more dangerous if they try to use it.
So I love the I have Bluetooth in my car, and on the steering wheel I can answer a phone call just by touching my thumb to a little button. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about simply answering the phone. You're talking about voice systems that are supposed to control almost everything in your interior environment in your car.
That's absolutely right. And what happened, and the way the study was done, we sort of characterized each level of distraction almost like a hurricane, a category 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth. And a category 1 would be something pretty minor. Category 2 might be on the phone. And even at that, when you're on the phone and you press that hands-free button, you still have two hands on the wheel, you're not necessarily fully focused on your drive. There's really only about 2% of the population that can truly multitask, that can truly do two things as well at the same time. Most of us, the other 98% of us, what we can do is we can do one thing, and then we take away how well we do that while we're trying to do something else. So even though you push the button, you answer the phone call, if the phone call gets to the point where you have to think about what you're saying, is something very important, something more important than I'll pick up milk and bread on the way home, but something that you have to really think about and have a discussion, you take away your primary focus of what you should be doing behind the wheel, and that's just driving. And it's even to the point where they, in the course of doing the study, Dr. David Strayer and Joel Cooper from the University of Utah, in the course of doing the study, they also happened to look at Siri and how well Siri responds. And what they found is they actually categorized Siri in the iPhones as a category 4 distraction because of how it sometimes works and sometimes just completely doesn't work.
Holy cow. Well, how does all this compare to just having passengers in the car? You know, we all have those conversations where you're turning your head back and forth between the road and the person you're talking to, or maybe we don't, but we see other people doing that or gesturing with their hands. How distracting is it just to have passengers who are talking to you?
Well, passengers are also very distracting. In fact, with novice drivers, what happens in a lot of cases is when you add an additional passenger to the car, the chances of getting into a crash go up exponentially, kind of in pretty significant increase, 20 to 25%. Now, in my car, my passenger I drive with mostly is my wife, and different than someone on the on the phone with me, we're driving down the road, and my wife will say, oh, did you see that car stopping up there? Did you see that ball come into the street, or did you see that? You're not getting that when you're on the phone with somebody. So to some extent, when we have another passenger in the car and we're having a conversation, they're still driving, even though there isn't a steering wheel behind in front of them.
Another set of eyes on the road.
Exactly.
And Jamie, one thing I wanted to talk to you about, and maybe both of you, is I'm reading all these articles about what a fantastic year it's been for automakers, how sales are terrific, and analysts are expecting the trend to continue. What are you seeing? What is selling well, and what is expected to sell well in 2015?
I mean, compact SUVs are an incredibly popular part of the market, and they're only getting more popular. And I mean, you can see that in the types of new models that automakers are rolling out, especially what we sort of think of as subcompact SUVs. And these are the ones that are even smaller than something like a Honda CR-V. These tend to be more within luxury car makers, although some affordable car makers have these smaller SUVs coming out, like Honda has one that's actually based on the Honda Fit that'll be coming out. But these compact SUVs are really great and very popular, driving a lot of sales. You also, of course, have the most popular segment within the market is midsize cars, which, again, makes complete and total sense because these are cars that make complete and total sense for most people. You know, whether you've got a couple of kids, these cars can handle it. Whether you're just, you and a spouse, these cars can handle it. If it's just a single person, it works for people like that. But what we're really seeing, driving these sales is a couple of things. One, it's pent-up demand. We're still coming out of the recession. People are maybe feeling a little bit better, a little bit more willing to spend their money. And so they're going to look for new cars. And what's partnered along with that is that lending standards have actually loosened a little bit for cars. So it's easier for people to get the credit that they need to buy the cars they want. Now, some people are sounding alarm bells over this. Actually, the New York Times has done a great series of articles about subprime auto lending, which is very similar to the subprime mortgage crisis that, of course, helped bring on the recession. Basically, where people are being given loans for cars that they may not necessarily be able to afford, those loans are then bundled and sold to investors. And so it really is the factors of easier credit and pent-up demand that are driving these sales. And you see a lot of models that are making huge sale gains and a lot of new models being rolled out by automakers hoping to take advantage of this momentum before it lets up.
Very interesting. As promised, we will talk about getting your car ready for winter. When we get back, we will also have your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Mimic, a workers' compensation insurance company dedicated to safer workplaces, fair treatment for all workers, and a strong Maine economy. On the web at mimic.com. And Hospice of Southern Maine, exploring spirituality in end-of-life care at the Thresholds Conference, November 5th and 6th. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org.
MPBN's Final Two, Your Vote 2014 debates take place this week. And once again, we are asking questions submitted by the public. If you have a question for the candidates, for U.S. Senate or for governor, please email them as soon as possible to yourvote@mpbn.net. That's Your Vote at mpbn.net. And then don't forget to watch or listen Wednesday at 8 for the Senate debate, Thursday at 8 for the gubernatorial debate, and of course, online at mpbn.net.
Somehow I've made it into my mid-30s never owning a car. I'm Ari Shapiro, international correspondent for NPR. Although having a bicycle does sort of align with my Portland, Oregon public radio upbringing. When my bike goes to that great bicycle graveyard in the sky, it's probably going to end up on the trash heap. But if it had been a car, I could have turned it into the programs I love. Here's how.
Just head to our website, mpbn.net, and click on the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program button in the top left corner. You're listening to MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Cars with Jamie and John. John Paul is a certified mechanic and columnist for Boston.com. Jamie Page Deaton is auto editor for U.S. News and World Report. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. John, this morning I put some air in my tires and thought to myself, do I need to put the snow tires on yet? Well, I don't think so. I think I'm going to wait a while. What kind of advice are you giving people for mid to late October?
Well, certainly it's time to really start to think about doing the preventative maintenance before the car actually breaks down and has a problem. What we have found by testing batteries throughout AAA is the typical life of a battery is somewhere between 4 and 5 years. So if you're driving a 4 or 5 year old car and the battery is original to the car, at least go in and have it tested. You may find the battery's in good shape. My car is getting older. In fact, both my car and my wife's car are both getting older. And I tested both batteries to make sure that they were okay. They're in pretty good shape. But still, you want to make sure that it's in good shape because the battery is one of the big things. Also, all the vital fluids in the car, the engine antifreeze, the engine coolant is important. If you're not putting snow tires on the car, make sure the tires that you have, if they're all season tires, are in good shape, they have good tread. We've done some studies recently that really show the difference in how a car performs once the tires get to be a little bit more than half worn, and they just don't work that well in snowy or rainy weather. So look at tire condition as well. Look at all the belts and radiator hoses. The engine thermostat, make sure the car warms up, not just to keep you warm, but also to make sure the defroster is going to work in the car. If you've ever driven down the road and your windshield starts to freeze up while you're driving, one of the reasons that causes that is you're not getting enough hot air on the windshield, and that temperature coming out of the heater duct should be hot enough to be able to keep that windshield ice free. So you need to look at a lot of little things, even things like windshield wiper blades. I like to change my windshield wiper blades at least twice a year. Usually the summertime is tough on windshield wipers. The heat is really hard on the rubber of the wiper, but going to a windshield wiper blade that's really designed for winter use, it might be one of these ones that the framework is all covered with rubber, or what's called a unibeam wiper, which is a wiper blade that looks like it's one piece. It doesn't have the kind of like the finger arrangement that holds the blade, the insert in place. What that is, it's much better when you're driving in the wintertime. The windshield wiper doesn't freeze up with ice and snow as you're driving. So doing some of this preventative stuff right now is really important to make sure your car is going to get through winter and get through winter correctly. And I really recommend for people that are driving in the winter weather, really consider snow tires and really consider four snow tires. That makes a huge difference in how well your car not only just gets going, but how well it stops on snowy roads.
All right. Thanks, John Paul. We're going to get to the questions. This is from Susan in Portland. An email to start. Is there any early word on the new Jeep Renegade? I'm intrigued by the size and reported fuel economy, but concerned about Jeep's overall reputation. Jamie.
Oh, that is a really good question. We were actually just talking about the Jeep Renegade at work today, this morning.
Wow.
And so the Jeep Renegade is one of those super small SUVs we were talking about just a couple minutes ago. And it is due to come out on sale early in 2015 or very late in 2014. You know, it's difficult to say whether you should be concerned about, you know, Jeep's reputation. And I think what she's referring to is the reliability of Jeep, as well as other Chrysler brands, has not always been the best. I will say, though, in the past couple of years, Jeep has climbed in the J.D. Power dependability and reliability ratings. It always is a little bit of a risk, you know, when you buy any car. But I would just say, you know, keep an eye on it. See how Jeep does this year. I wouldn't necessarily be the first in line to buy a Renegade, but, you know, maybe give it 6 months so that all the new owners can work out the kinks for you before you decide to go on in and buy one. And I would say that, you know, with any new model, just, you know, give it 6 months. You don't want to be the guinea pig that everything being tested on.
All right, thanks, Jamie. We're going to go to a phone call. We have Ward and Gardner. Hi, Ward. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a 10-year-old Honda that has no rust on the body, but my mechanic said that it's starting to what he calls rot out underneath. And my question is, how often should I wash the next car, or this car maybe, hoping to last longer? At the car wash, you know, once or twice a week or every day or whatever. And number two is, how do I know from looking at the car wash whether or not they're washing under the car?
John Paul.
Well, you should really consider rinsing the car off periodically. But here's kind of a, I don't know, kind of a secret of car washes that sometimes makes me a little bit nervous. Car washes, in a lot of cases, are very environmentally conscious, but they also recycle a certain amount of water. So what can sometimes happen is, in the wintertime, and living in the Northeast, We're blessed with the fact that we put salt on our roads. We have salt in the air from, especially if you live near the coast anywhere. So our cars tend to rust and rot probably more than other parts of the country. So what you want to do, especially in the wintertime, if they've just salted all the roads, you're driving around, your car looks like it's a big white ghost now because it's just covered with salt, the best thing to do is find a place where you can actually try to rinse off the car with fresh water. Certainly kind of hard to do to get the hose out and hope it doesn't freeze in the wintertime, but the more you can rinse off the car, the better. The sooner you can get that salt out from underneath the car. The other issue is when you go to a car wash, a lot of times what you do is you pay extra for an undercarriage wash. The other issue with that is what you're doing is you're also spraying water and, again, sometimes water and salt mixture in places where water was never designed to go, because it will spray up in areas that might be covered over that driving down the road the salt would never get there, but now all of a sudden you've sprayed water pressure at a couple hundred pounds per square inch and it ends up ricocheting around under the car and may actually cause more rust. Unfortunately, living in the Northeast, we're faced with the fact that our cars rust out, and undercoating and those kind of things sometimes can help a little bit, but today's cars, especially newer cars, they're built in such a way they try to take up try to cover parts of them over with so they're more aerodynamic, so they get better gas mileage. Those are also areas which can collect salt and sand and cause more rust. So what I would try to do is, even in the wintertime, see if you can drag out a hose somewhere and maybe once a month or so get under there with the hose and try to rinse the car off as much as you can, or try to get that fresh salt off as much as you can. If that doesn't work, go to a car wash. If you're at the car wash and ask them how much they recycle their water. It's good that they do, but on the other hand, you want to make sure that there's no real salt content in the water. Some car washes actually keep a little bit of grit in the water, and that is actually what almost like sandblasts the other dirt off. Those are things that bother me a little bit. When I go to an automatic car wash and it smells either overly perfumed or smells like bad water, that's not a car wash I necessarily want to wash my car with.
Good advice. Thanks, Ward. And, well, it's interesting because I always chose the undercarriage, but not necessarily.
Well, it can cause a problem because you are, you know, you think about driving down the road and water splashing up under the car, but think about a pressure washer spraying up underneath the car. That can put water where it was never really designed to go. And, again, that mixture of salty water that might be used. So if I was going to an automatic car wash, as much as I'd want to get the salt off, I'd probably want to wait a few days after the sort of the worst of the water probably goes through the filtration system.
And just wait for those days where it's over 30 degrees and maybe hook up your hose at home.
Drag the hose out and wash it off. It's good exercise too.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Ward. A good question. We have an email with a whole bunch of questions. You guys ready? This is from Mark in Blue Hill. He says, could you please discuss interior air quality in new cars? Do you have any comparative information on various cars? Do you know anything about Subaru? Any comments on various ways to diminish off-gassing from new construction? What about ionizing? What about what they call baking? Okay, so that's going to be enough questions. We're going to start with the air quality, interior air quality. Is that an issue?
It can be. There are companies that have actually done studies on interior air quality of all kinds of things, cars and other things. And they're right that periodically what can happen is with so much plastic and foam and rubber parts inside a car, it does off-gas. It does actually send this sort of weird vapor into the air. That new car smell that everybody likes when they get in a car might not necessarily be that good for you, really. And it's a good idea when you have a new car to kind of let it ventilate a little bit to get all of these gases out of the car. Some do better than others. I think Honda actually has always done pretty good when tested for off-gassing. Some other manufacturers, not quite so much. As far as ionization, same thing if you, sometimes they'll put an air ionizer into a hotel room where someone had smoked to get rid of the smell. But driving with that type of device in the car has also shown to cause some breathing issues too. So I would be careful about that. So do a little bit of research if you're really concerned about it. But today's cars, so much plastic and foam and rubber parts in the car, you can get this you can get this gassing stuff. And again, that new car smell might not be that good for you.
Well, Mark asked, the end of his email says he'll have people in the car who have high sensitivity. So do you think it's a good idea to maybe buy a used car if you're looking for a car?
Well, certainly over time, that the plastics do off-gas. So certainly that could be a case. People that keep their windows wound up all the time, that's an issue. If you drive around with the ventilation system and recirculate, you're just recirculating that same gas. And the other thing, for people who aren't really aware of it, if you've ever gotten in your car and the inside of the windshield looks like there were smokers in the car almost, where it has that sort of film on the inside of the window, that's actually from the plastics off-gassing.
Mm. Jamie, I have a question. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to add to that, you know, that a number of car makers are making a little bit more people-friendly and earth-friendly products. I know the Prius, like the material on their seats, for example, is made from, you know, natural fibers and products that shouldn't off-gas as much as something that's a little bit more industrial and processed.
Jamie, I was going to ask you, a caller who couldn't stay on the line wants to know what you and John think the future is for AdBlue and diesel engines. What is AdBlue?
AdBlue is go ahead, John.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. No, okay.
Well, I'll talk about, I can talk about diesel engines. I think you probably have more to add on AdBlue. But diesel engines, I think, you know, they're becoming a little bit more popular in the United States. We're seeing more automakers bring them over. And we're seeing, you know, products that allow, or systems that allow the diesel engines to burn a little bit more cleanly and work with our emission standards a little bit better. And for a lot of people, you know, who aren't necessarily in heavy congested areas or city areas, you know, a diesel car makes a lot of sense because you can get such great mileage when you're on the highway.
And John, you want to talk about AdBlue? I don't know what that is.
It is an additive that goes into a container in the car, and it's an exhaust additive. It's an exhaust fluid additive that gets added to the car. It's actually urea. It's the actual chemical. And what it is, it's this additive that actually cleans up the exhaust system of a diesel engine and makes that diesel exhaust practically as clean as a gasoline car. And that's one of the reasons we didn't see a lot of diesel vehicles in the United States, especially passenger cars, because these diesel cars ran dirty and they couldn't meet the emissions levels. We came out with ultra low sulfur fuel, which helped with that, and then we add this additive to the car. And that's one of the things that I always try to tell people, is that when they're thinking about buying a diesel car, they also need to think about the extra cost associated with this diesel additive called AdBlue, or exhaust diesel fluid is sometimes more of a generic term to what it is. But now we're starting to see, you can, you know, if you own a diesel car, you can go to Walmart and buy gallons of this AdBlue. And I think what's going to happen with diesel cars and the diesel additive, it's going to be as readily available as going to the store and buying windshield washer fluid.
And do you need to, if you have a diesel car? My husband has a TDI Sportwagon diesel. Does he need to be adding this?
In his car, no. But if you decide that the TDI Sportwagon is too small of a vehicle and you need to go to a SAW,
John Paul, there's something very strange going on with your audio. I'm going to ask you that question again after the break. And we are going to also get to Harvey and Augusta after a break. So we'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as does Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to canning their entire line to protect the beer and the environment. BaxterBrewing.com. And Casella, committed to effectively managing non-recyclable waste while protecting the environment. Casella, giving resources new life.
The very first car I bought was a second-hand Cinquecento.
I'm Silvia Poggioli.
And it was simply perfect for narrow Italian streets. And when you had friends, the Cinquecento had the magical ability of circus cars. You could always pile in more people than the law of physics would allow. Or maybe we were all much thinner then. It's amazing to think that even that little car could be turned into my favorite programs.
For more information, visit mpbn.net and click on the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program button in the top left corner. Coming up in about 20 minutes on Speaking in Maine, We'll go next to Northport and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The speaker is Jim Hightower, an enormously entertaining national radio commentator, writer, public speaker, and author of the book Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. That's coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Jamie and John answer your car questions. Jamie Page Deaton is auto editor for U.S. News and World Report. She joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. John Paul is public affairs manager for AAA Southern New England. He joins us from his office. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. John Paul, do you sound like yourself again?
I don't know. Do I?
Oh, you do. That sounds terrific.
Okay.
So right before we left, I think you said that if you have a diesel, Volkswagen, Sport Wagon, don't need to add the AdBlue.
That's right. In your particular car, the Jetta, because of the weight and size of the car, doesn't need the additive. But if you decided you wanted to move up to, say, like a Volkswagen Passat, you would need to have that additive. And it's in a separate tank. It's located somewhere conspicuously in the car. And what happens is if you run the car to the point where you run out of this additive, it'll turn on a service light or a light that'll tell you it's time to go in and add it and make sure that the car is not polluting the air. So the additive makes the car much cleaner, and that's what's important about it.
Okay, as promised, we're going to Harvey in Augusta. Hi, Harvey, go ahead.
Good morning. A couple of things while I was waiting that reminded me. Washing the underside of the car, if you go into a parking lot where there's no salt on the road, you just run through a puddle real fast to get the underside. Anyway, what I called about was the earlier comment on bells and whistles on cars, and I had an expensive experience that suggested another bell and whistle somebody could add to a car, and that would be a heated front fender liner, so that in the winter when the ice starts building up around your wheel, the rear wheel, it isn't a problem because the rear wheel just keeps it chewed off, you know, where it needs it, but the front wheel, it turns, and it doesn't. I one time tried to make a turn, and the wheel pushed against the ice underneath the fender, and it pulled the whole fender out of line. I had to go into a body shop and have it readjusted. If they could have something that would just, you know, you could push a button about every 10 minutes or so, and it would heat up enough so that the ice underneath the front fender would fall off.
Harvey, maybe you should patent your idea.
Well, I'm not in the patenting business, but, you know, just something for somebody to chew on and think about. It would be a big help up in the northern, you know, in Maine.
John, is this a problem that you've seen over the years as a mechanic, that the ice buildup under the fender causes problems?
Well, it can be, I suppose, especially today. We're actually seeing it probably a little bit more, because if you look at cars today, look at the size of the wheels and the tires in relationship to the wheel opening, and more snow can build up inside there. So it's important to get out there periodically, and especially after 3 or 4 days of bad winter weather, and at least kind of knock that snow off of there to keep that from happening. Things like trucks and SUVs, usually there's a lot of area around the wheel that's not going to be as common, but still, it's still a good idea to make sure, you know, when in winter weather, clean all your car off, and, you know, take the back end of your snow brush and, you know, try to knock as much snow off of the wheel well arches as possible. I think you'd need a really big battery in your car to heat up fender wells to keep them from melting, but you never know. With technology, it might be the next big thing.
Thanks for your call, Harvey. And going to Winterport, and Doug, go ahead, Doug.
Hello. I was curious. I drive a Prius, and in the summertime, I have what they call low-resistance tires, but I don't trust them enough. I've never used them in the wintertime, so I put on all-weather tires in the winter. And I was just wondering if either of your the people there knew anything about the low-resistance tires, if they're safe in snow to drive.
I have a feeling I know your answer, John Paul.
They're not going to do the job that a good winter tire would do, especially the Prius is a fairly light car to start off with. So having that extra traction is going to help. And I would, as much as I'm pretty frugal and try to maintain as much fuel economy as I could, in a Prius, if the Prius was a car that I needed to drive in bad winter weather, I would put the snow tires on. I think it's an important thing to do. It's going to give you the best traction, and the car's just going to behave a little bit better. So if you were driving, you know, in the southern states, not a problem at all. If you were intermittently, if there was a little snow here and there, not a problem. It used to be that an all-season tire, and especially a low rolling resistance all-season tire, was pretty good in 4 or 5 inches of snow, but once the snow starts to come down, it's just not going to do the job anymore, and that's where a good snow tire makes a difference.
Thanks, Doug. Going to Winthrop and Nate. Hi, Nate. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I heard your comment briefly a moment ago about the smaller SUVs, and it got me to thinking about in the late 70s and early 80s, my uncle and cousin were both construction contractors, and they had small pickup trucks, Datsun, Nissan, Volkswagen. Ram made a Ram 50. These are nice little pickup trucks that were affordable to drive, got good gas mileage. I'd love to see something like that again, and it was disappointing for me to find out Suzuki's not selling their small vehicles in the U.S., like a Volkswagen TDI pickup. Do you see anything like that emerging on the horizon?
Jamie, it's interesting because every time we do a show with you two, at least one person calls looking for a small pickup truck. It seems like that's a market opportunity for someone.
Yeah, and actually, you know, just a few years ago, American car makers actually left the small pickup market, and they're coming back. GM has the Chevy Colorado and the GMC Canyon. And those are, you know, they're not as small as the old, you know, pickups that the caller's talking about, but they are smaller than the full-size pickups that you'll see. So, I mean, there's still, you have some small pickup options out there. You know, Suzuki did stop selling its small pickup truck, but it was actually just a rebadged Nissan Frontier. So if you're interested in getting that Suzuki, well, you can just go buy a Nissan Frontier, and it's, you know, the two trucks were built same side by side in the same factory. So you can still get that sort of small truck that you're looking for. But I think there's a lot of excitement about the reintroduction of the Chevy Colorado and the GMC Canyon, because these trucks are perfect for, not necessarily if you have, like, say, a large contracting business, but they're perfect for the weekend warrior who wants a truck for hauling their toys around on the weekends, but still wants something that's comfortable and economical for commuting and doesn't want to commit to a full-on, you know, gas guzzling pickup truck. So I think this is a market that, you know, GM is back testing in. And if it does, if they do well and these trucks, you know, continue to sell, then I think that we will see more automakers enter into it.
Good question, Nate. Thank you. Going to Tom in Livermore. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great.
Great. If I may, I'll proceed my question with a very quick comment on a previous topic. That was underbody rust. The only good news about underbody rust is that you don't have to worry about going out in your driveway at 10 below and washing under your car, because brine does freeze, and it freezes at about 10 or 15 degrees. Once it's frozen, it's not corrosive anymore. The brine, the salt mixture that you need to worry about is the springtime brine or the wintertime thaw brine. That's when you need to be rinsing out your car, and it's not so bad at 35 degrees to be out there rinsing your car.
Okay, and you had another question too, right?
I do, yes. I'm wondering if the your panelists have heard any mention about problems with Ford compact car transmissions. A very good friend of mine drives hundreds of different cars a day because he drives for a rental car company, and it is his opinion that 70 to 75% of the new Ford compact cars, the Focuses and the Fusion, have major defects with their transmissions. They have many of them out of service, and they have many of them returned by customers for being undrivable.
Do either of you have any experience with this? Have you heard about this?
A little bit with the Focus. The Focus uses a dual clutch transmission. It is essentially a manual transmission with an automatic clutch. And what happens is, and it's probably very specific to the rental car market more than somebody who drives a car all the time, the car actually learns the shift characteristics of how a particular person drives it. We actually run in the AAA office that I work for, we actually run a driving school, and we have experienced some of those same problems with our Ford Focuses because they get driven by kids and different instructors all the time, and we've seen some of those problems start to crop up. You talk to somebody that owns a Ford, a late model Ford Focus 2013, 2014, and they're the only driver. They've had pretty good luck with it, but it's that getting in and out and driving characteristics are slightly different. The car will tend to hold its gear a little bit longer when the engine's cold. If you're sitting on a hill, like most people do, with just kind of resting your foot on the gas pedal, you can actually overheat the clutch. So it is a little different technique because it's a different type of transmission. I haven't heard of any problems with the Fusion, though. But definitely the Focus is a car worth considering when you're thinking about transmissions and transmission problems.
Thanks, John, and thanks, Tom, for the call. Going to Barbara in Ogunquit. Hi, Barbara. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have questions about a Prius. I have a 2011. It's my first Prius, and it has 66,000 miles. Now, I'm thinking about trading it in. And the question is, do I do that now, or do I wait for that 2015, which is supposed to be a new model? And I'm looking for advice.
Jamie, do you have any thoughts?
I would wait for the 2015, which you might be able to actually, it might be hitting dealers sooner than you think. Most of the 2015s actually come out in 2014. So I would actually start, if I were you, and you're definitely going to get a new car, I would go ahead and start looking to trade it in. Start going to the dealers. Don't mention that you have a trade. Like, that's the one piece of advice that we always give with car shoppers. What you want to do is you want to work out the price of the new car separately from the price of your trade, because what will happen is if you try and do the same both deals at the same time, a lot of times dealers will try and take their profit out of one end or the other. So you might think that you're getting a great deal on your new car because you're saving so many thousands of dollars, but then they actually end up undervaluing your trade. And you also want to make sure that when you go in to trade that car in, that you have done your research before you actually hit the dealership. So make sure that you know exactly what your car is worth. Kelley Blue Book, which is at KBB.com, is one good resource for that. There are other couple sites that will give you an idea of what that 2011 Prius is worth, which I would guess, Barbara, that Prius with, 2011, 66,000 miles is actually going to be a good deal for the dealer who ends up buying it, because the Prius is in high demand. Gas prices aren't as high as, they once were, but there are a lot of people out there who would really like to buy a nice used Prius, and they tend to do very well as used cars, and they tend to hold their value very well. And with 66,000 miles on it, you've still got a lot of the battery warranty left. So I would say, Barbara, go ahead and wait for the 2015, trade your car in then.
Okay, Barbara. Yeah, thanks for the question. We have a Facebook question for you, John. I'm hoping you're sounding good over there. The question is, my mechanic wants to put rust protectant on my car. Is it worth it?
Generally not. It's sort of one step removed from snake oil. Years ago, there used to be all these different types of rust protectant things, and most of them don't work. The factory rust protectant is sprayed on from the factory. It works pretty well. Anything additional you have to be careful, because you can be actually trapping dirt, sand, and salt between the rust protectant and the car if the car is not brand new too. So I would avoid it. I would just follow the advice of both the caller that called in. Clean the car off when the temperature gets a little warmer, and get that salty mix, that brine mix off your car before it causes a problem.
Okay, going to Orland and Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm considering an electric car. I'm one of many people who are concerned about global warming, and Union of Concerned Scientists says that each of our carbon footprints are most heavily affected by transportation, the cars that we drive. So I'm really interested, and I'd like to know what you folks have to say about electric cars and which ones are the best deals and so forth.
Jamie, has U.S. News and World Report done any studies, any recommendations on the best electric cars?
Well, I think, you know, we have a number of rankings that cover all of the, you know, electric and plug-in hybrid cars. The one thing that I would make sure the caller knows, though, since she's specifically interested in reducing her carbon footprint, is know where your electricity is coming from, if where you're going to plug the car in. Because
I have photoelectric system in
then
my house.
You are good to go. You are good to go. I would say go get your electric car. There are a number of good ones. I don't know what your price point is, but the Nissan Leaf is a very good small electric car. It's one of the most affordable ones. There's the Ford Focus Electric, which is another affordable electric car. And of course, when I say affordable, I mean, you're still talking about around, you know, a little bit over $30,000, but with tax credits, it would end up costing you a little bit less. I have a colleague who has a Fiat 500 electric that he absolutely loves. And of course, there's the big electric that everybody knows about is the Tesla Model S, which is luxurious, has a great long range, is wonderful to drive, but again, can end up being super duper expensive. I would also recommend too, you know, if you have any concerns about range with an electric car, and charging stations and infrastructure, a plug-in hybrid is another great way to go, because if you get, say, a Toyota Prius plug-in, you can get about 19 miles of electric range, which is plenty for, you know, most people driving around, going to work, doing their errands. And then if you're still out and about, haven't made it home yet to charge or to plug back in, then you have a gas engine to back it up. The Chevy Volt is another car that does that, and the Ford C-Max Energy, and there's also the Ford Fusion Energy is also a plug-in hybrid, where you get both, where you can plug it in using your solar power and then have that gas engine as a backup if you really need it.
Jamie, that's going to be the last question. Thank you so much for your call, Margaret. Jamie Page Deaton is the auto editor for U.S. News and World Report. John Paul, public affairs manager for AAA of Southern New England. He's also a certified mechanic and columnist for Boston.com. Thanks, both of you, for coming back and being regulars on Main Calling. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Our intern, Josh Gauthier, answered your calls. You can find past editions of Main Calling, as well as a link of to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/maincalling. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow, Ebola and other infectious diseases. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Main Calling on MPBN.
You make Main Calling possible, as does Revision Energy, now offering Own Your Power loans for solar energy systems. More at revisionenergy.com. And CEI, working with small and medium-sized businesses, focusing on economy, equity, and environment. CEIMaine.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, as Ebola continues to spread in West Africa, President Obama steps up efforts to address the crisis. The latest developments here and abroad, tracking those who were exposed, and the debate over travel bans.
Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show today at 2 o'clock here on MPBN Radio. You're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. We are WMEH in Bangor, 90.9, WMEA in Portland, 90.1, WMEP in Camden, 90.5, WMEM in Presque Isle, 106.1, WMED in Calais, 89.7, WMEW Waterville, 91.3, WMEF in Fort Kent on 106.5, and online at mpbn.net. The Maine Public Broadcasting Network was founded by the University of Maine System and Colby, Bates, and Bowdoin Colleges. Coming up ahead, our Public Affairs Hour at 1 o'clock. Community support is what makes public affairs programming possible, together with the Maine Community Foundation. Pleased to support Speaking in Maine, a forum for addressing issues affecting Maine people and the world. And Catherine McCauley, hosting an open house for prospective students, Sunday, October 26th at 1 p.m., McCauleyhs.org.